The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, December 9th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. And we begin with major developments in Syria this week. The Syrian army has now retaken 75% of eastern Aleppo, which rebels held for the last 4 years. On Thursday, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov announced a halt to combat in the city. The intention was to permit the evacuation of nearly 8,000 civilians trapped in that war zone. But aid workers say the fighting has not stopped. Here's Pavel Krishik, the communications coordinator for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Syria.
Unfortunately, the prospects right now in Aleppo city are not getting better. The fighting continues to spread in more and more districts. Yesterday, for instance, in one of the districts of Aleppo's old city, we managed to evacuate 150 civilians from the elderly house that was sheltering people with disabilities, mentally ill patients, orphans that were for days trapped there on the front line in the middle of the fighting without any possibilities for us to actually rescue them. Unfortunately, some people did not make it. We were late. 11 people actually died before we managed to arrive, but it's only tip of an iceberg of what is really, really needed, or what will be needed if this fighting continue at such intensity.
Pavel Krishik spoke with us on Thursday and will return to Aleppo this weekend. A possible deal between the U.S. and Russia that would permit Syrian rebels to leave Aleppo unharmed and allow civilians to evacuate is reportedly still being discussed. Secretary of State John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov have been having sideline discussions at international meetings. So far, those discussions have led to no agreement. Robin Wright is joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a contributing writer for The New Yorker. And she says the fighting in Aleppo is a major turning point in what's been a nearly 6-year conflict.
Well, the United States wants more than just a temporary ceasefire. It wants to ultimately to find some kind of diplomatic resolution. The Russians, on the other hand, feel they have the upper hand, that their ally in Damascus, President Bashar Assad, is now on the winning side, because Aleppo really is a psychological and political turning point, as well as a military conquest. This is the largest city in Syria. It has been a symbol for almost a year now of the raging battle and the fight for the soul and identity and direction of Syria. And so the best we can hope out of this negotiation is probably a short-term ceasefire that will allow more civilians to leave. The problem, of course, is many of the rebels already fear that if they give up, if they stop fighting, that they're basically dead men, whether they're hauled into prison or worse, that the loss of Aleppo means, you know, that there's nothing in the future. And that has implications for the outside world, too, because the rebels that the West has backed now for so long have failed to be able to protect their own territory and are not much of a viable force, at least in Aleppo.
That suggests in some way, Robin Wright, that the choice for the United States here in this negotiation over Aleppo is saving the lives of some of these civilians who might be able to evacuate if there's a ceasefire on the one hand, and on the other hand, selling out anti-Assad rebels who we've been backing, at least putatively, during this entire war.
The tragedy is that for the United States and its Western allies, there have never been a lot of attractive options in Syria that would lead to the kind of outcome they preferred. And the United States has backed rebel forces. They were never large enough, never well-armed enough, never cohesive enough to present a viable challenge long-term to President Assad. And this war has now gone on for 6 years. And at this point, one of the amazing things is that President Assad not only has survived 6 years after many predicted he would be gone in a matter of weeks, but that he may actually come out of this at least a partial winner.
Robin Wright, the former U.S. ambassador to the Syria transition, Frederick Hoff, was on the show last week, and he said that in his view, there's still time in the Obama administration in these last 40 days or so for the president to demand military options just to help stop the slaughter in Aleppo. Is there any possibility of anything like that in a realistic scenario here?
There are probably no viable military options that would prevent the fall of Aleppo, eastern Aleppo, where the rebels have been fighting. They've lost something like 75% of the area. They may be able to hold some corner, some pocket, but ultimately it will be very hard for them to live under siege with limited access to things like electricity and water and food. So, you know, the battle is, it would seem at this stage, almost over.
So what is this moment then for U.S. foreign policy? It's worth looking at because we're really caught now between two things, it strikes me, between the sting of the experience of adventurism in Iraq and what that did to American foreign policy and the ideals of, you know, the Samantha Power Doctrine. The United States intervenes on behalf of beleaguered people when we can use our might to save their lives, a place like Rwanda, for instance, or Kosovo. Basically, we have U.S. paralysis here. What's the best way to see the U.S. posture now in the Middle East with Russia on the rise, Assad probably staying on, and Donald Trump taking over power?
Well, first of all, the war in Syria is not over. There are still significant parts of the country not under President Assad's control. In Idlib province, for example, the largest of the five al-Qaeda franchises in the world now has a strong base, and there will continue to be operations there. You still have ISIS operating in Syria. One of the ironies is that the United States and its allies on the ground, the Iraqi military, are making progress against ISIS, and that the largely Kurdish militia in Syria is making progress against ISIS. ISIS has lost a total of 40% of its caliphate, 57% of its territory in Iraq, almost 30% of its territory in Syria. On one military front, there is hopeful news. But of course, the big question is, what follows the Islamic State? And this is one place where there's a real challenge for the next administration. There are a lot of political questions, the ones that are not just military. But to your question about the United States, it is clear that when it comes to Syria, which is in many ways one of the most geostrategically important countries in the entire Middle East, because of all the countries it borders, because of its location, that Russia and Iran and their allies in Hezbollah from Lebanon come out far ahead of the others. But the battle's not over. There are five different wars playing out in Syria, and the one between the rebels and President Assad is only one of them.
Robin Wright, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Robin Wright is joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Let's go to Seoul in South Korea now, where earlier today the parliament voted overwhelmingly to impeach President Park Geun-hye. It's all a response to a corruption scandal that's enraged that nation and frozen President Park's ability to lead. The Constitutional Court now has to consider whether to remove her from office. That's a process that could take up to 6 months. Now, President Park has not indicated at this time that she'd be willing to go on her own and resign. Suki Kim is contributing editor for The New Republic and author of Without You, There Is No Us. Suki Kim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, hi.
So what's next in the process here, and is she likely to be removed?
Because the margin was so high, I mean, it was 234 for the impeachment against 56. You need 200 votes. So that's 34 votes over the limit. With that, and also, you know, another part about that is the people's reaction. You know, last weekend, there were 2.3 million people on the streets of Seoul protesting against President Park. So at this point, she can't come back. It takes about 6 months, but they think with this wide margin, the court will decide quickly. And once that decision happens, and if she were to even step out before that, then a new election has to happen immediately after that.
So is she likely to go on her own before that? As I said before, she hasn't said she would resign now. A couple of weeks ago, when the pressure was on, she suggested that she might be willing to step down on her own. It seems a little at odds.
You know, that speech actually is kind of was the fuel to the fire, because somehow it was immediately reported around the world as if she said she was resigning. She did say that, but she played this really manipulative card where if you translate verbatim, it sounded like she was going to resign. But what she said back then was that she is willing to resign according to the will of the parliament. The parliament only has one thing they can do, which is an impeach the president, which was already being brought up. So all she could do, according to the will of the parliament, is to be fired from her job. But she put it in this way, willing to resign business. And that really angered people, because she still was not saying that she was at fault for anything. In that speech also, she made sure to say she was not guilty for anything herself. She was only guilty for people around her mismanaging them. That's putting blame on everyone else. So that speech, which somehow looked apologetic, if you translate it, was actually the most offensive speech she could have given to the people. And in reaction to that, people really, before that was 1 million. It was now over 2 million people on the street last weekend. And that totally changed the things, because no one thought it was going to be this much margin at the impeachment votes.
And so now there's just a great deal of uncertainty in Seoul, isn't there? Not only the impeachment of South Korea's own president, but South Korea diplomatically has been extremely nervous about political transitions in the United States. Donald Trump's comments about South Korea and Japan and their alliance in nuclear weapons in the region and China, it's got a lot of South Koreans on edge. It's just coming at them from all angles here.
It's fascinating. I feel like, you know, everything is so uncertain and there must be something in the stars. What's going on with the United States? And now suddenly we have the first ever history. You know, it looks like the impeachment, there's no way really she can come back from this. Then the first president in history to be impeached in South Korea. You know, oddly enough, the one really would be laughing at this and celebrating is North Korea. Because traditionally, the left, which will now take over in South Korea, has been pro-North Korea. And North Korea all along preferred Trump as a candidate. So, you know, they are sort of a double win for North Korea right now.
Suki Kim, contributing editor at The New Republic. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's been a week packed with cabinet appointments as Donald Trump amasses his government. There was the Army Corps' decision not to approve an easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there was Pizzagate, a viral fake news story about a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C. with non-existent ties to child trafficking. The story's false, but that didn't stop a gunman from opening fire inside the restaurant. He admitted to the New York Times that the intel wasn't 100% on that story before he decided to carry through with his plan. A view from the right now on these issues and more with Noah Rothman, assistant online editor at the Conservative Monthly Commentary Magazine. We started our conversation with his understanding of the Dakota Access protests, where Rothman says the reprieve won by the pipeline protesters may be short-lived.
Well, it's a victory, but it might be a temporary victory. This was the result of the Army Corps' decision to back off in September, back off construction and begin the process of working with the protesters, and the results of all the indignation over this decision that had been made a long time ago after the course of consultations with local tribes, historical reviews, environmental impact analyses. So it was kind of a surprise when the U.S. Army backed off, and NBC News' reporting revealed that this was the result of civilian political appointees determining that it was just the costs had outweighed the benefits. So it could be reversed, theoretically, in a Trump administration, but we've possibly seen some dangerous precedents in the form of giving in to protesters who demonstrated violently. You could call it mob violence. I think I'm comfortable with that. So if we have an administration that wants to roll up these kind of protests, they're not going to be as afraid of the dangerous optics, the bad optics of taking apart a tent city as the Obama administration had been.
Who makes Democrats more squeamish than Pruitt at EPA, especially Democrats who've devoted so much of their political capital to the idea that climate change is an emergency that needs to be addressed?
Well, it depends on what their priorities are, right? I mean, Mnuchin at Treasury is somebody who is going to make the income inequality left very disturbed, very squeamish. Wilbur Ross is also another person who's going to be somebody that the left, I think, is going to have a lot of problems with. And as I said, if you're going to choose one fight to fight, and they probably do have to choose one fight to fight, I don't know if the EPA is the way to go about it, particularly if the progressive wing of the left emerges ascendant. You know, that was the big complaint against Hillary Clinton, her kind of staid status quo liberalism lost. And in pursuit of energy, anything resembling energy, they're going to seek somebody who generates crowds and enthusiasm. And that's the progressive wing. That's Elizabeth Warren. That's Bernie Sanders, et cetera. So while the environmental stuff does get the activists energized, I'm not entirely sure that you can build a movement on that.
You know, Noah, I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. And in fact, I've spent some time at Comet Pizza and Ping Pong on Connecticut Avenue, the place where, of course, an armed man walked in to investigate what he thought were credible claims of child sex rings going on. This is all about fake news, of course, which led to the firing from the Trump transition team of the son of national security advisor-to-be Michael Flynn. I wonder if you've sensed any true reckoning or any introspection on the right about the phenomenon of fake news. Not that most people involved, you know, in elite politics consume it or care about it, but that maybe large parts of the Trump coalition have been brought to the party in part because of it.
Possibly. I've not sensed that kind of introspection, perhaps because it's just a little early. We're still in the honeymoon period where a lot of people who didn't support Donald Trump during the primaries are now expressing themselves as Trump supporters. The reluctant are now embracing him. So I have not sensed that. But a true reckoning is coming not only for Republicans but for Democrats. It is the out party that is mostly susceptible to this kind of abusive, naked kind of a attempt to create false hope. And you saw that, the very first beginning evidences of the era of liberal scam packs with Jill Stein's approach to creating and fundraising for a recount in states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, where she drew very minimal percentage of the votes, where the recounts that have so far been counted have only increased Donald Trump's tally, and where she raised much more money than she even remotely needed for this sort of thing. So Republicans were plagued by what were called scam packs, were essentially fundraising operations that padded the bottom lines of organizing groups and didn't do much in the way of activists. I think we're beginning to see the beginning of that on the left, and that is very much what fuels the quote-unquote fake news phenomenon.
Well, I can appreciate the idea, you know, that both sides do it, which is kind of common in politics here. But the phenomenon of fake news itself, the sort of internet-driven, narrative-driven phenomenon industry that appears to be designed to interest people in politics who otherwise might not be interested at all, has been a phenomenon, at least in this election cycle, not of both sides, right? So I wonder if you sense that continuing, even if Republicans aren't the out party. I mean, there's lots of people who are joining the dance here, maybe because of it.
I don't see this disappearing on the right tomorrow, for certainly. As long as there's a demand for information that confirms biases and that provides you emotional satisfaction, that's stimulating in a way that I don't think news is supposed to be. So you look only to the 4 days' worth of Hamilton coverage, where you had the Hamilton cast lecturing Mike Pence from the stage. What did America learn from that? Nothing. But we all wanted to weigh in on it. Everybody had an opinion. There was no barrier to entry there. You didn't need any understanding of history or politics or policy. You could just know the facts straight up within 30 seconds and form a fully articulate opinion. And that's the market that I think is corrupting news.
Noah Rothman, it's been great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Noah Rothman is the assistant online editor at Commentary Magazine.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about. And that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
Stick with me and we'll claw our way to the top.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
Friday's the time to talk movies here on The Takeaway, the weekend movie releases with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, who's here with me. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you back. We're going to be talking about La La Land today. We have Office Christmas Party. I'm going to start you with trivia.
Okay.
Stemming from La La Land. It stars, who's
Emma Stone.
Emma Stone. That's,
Ryan
she's
Gosling.
She's the one I was looking for. I was looking at the wrong movie. That's why. Emma Stone is the trivia that we're talking about here. This is an audio trivia cut. Save your answer. We're going to come back to this. Thanks for the help with Emma Stone.
Sure.
Emma Stone is in another movie. Here's a hilarious Emma Stone moment from earlier in her career, long before La La Land, a tragic dying scene. Listen.
I'm sorry, it just gets me. But it still is sad.
What movie is that, and whose death is Emma Stone cracking up about? That's your trivia question. Hold on to it. We'll come back to it. Rafer, La La Land, director Damien Chazelle and Emma Stone, of course.
Right. Original musical, the rare original musical, not based on a play. She and Ryan Gosling play a couple in Los Angeles. He's a jazz pianist. She is an aspiring actress, and they meet and they fall in love.
Let's listen. I watched this trailer and I thought, I'm a Fiona Apple fan, and there's part of these jazz standards in this story that appeals to me here.
Yeah, I mean, the score is very lushly orchestrated, beautifully done, some very clever, funny moments. There's a wonderful duet they do in Griffith Park that gets interrupted by an iPhone cell ring, and it fits into the melody beautifully. So a lot of great stuff like that. I do wish the songs had stuck in my head a little bit more. And even though Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone are beautiful together, they're really the only two characters in the film. And I wanted a little bit more. I wanted other voices in that film. And you don't quite get that enough. It becomes a little repetitive there. But it's a beautiful film, probably going to win Best Oscar. New York Film Critics Circle, of which I am a member, voted it their Best Picture.
Wow.
So you probably look for this to win the Best Picture Oscar.
That's a huge vote of confidence for La La Land from Rafer Guzman. A very different film, Office Christmas Party, seems insane and stupid and kind of funny.
Yes. Well, this is by the members, the guys who did The Hangover, of course. Yeah. Jennifer Aniston, Jason Bateman, Big Office Christmas Party. If they can just throw a party wild enough to impress a big client, maybe they can save the company. You know, it's not a great movie, pretty good cast, some fun moments. If you manage your expectations, I think you can have a good time.
And Kate McKinnon is soaring. They put her at the top of the trailer because everybody loves her.
Because
so it might an easy,
wonderful,
fun one to watch.
Yes. Rob Corddry as well. Good cast.
All right. Let's get to your trivia before we let you go. Rafer, we were talking about Emma Stone in La La Land. I gave you a hilarious clip from earlier in her career, a dying scene. Listen.
I'm sorry, it just gets me.
Rafer?
Todd, you've stumped me. Got nothing.
That's Bill Murray dying in Zombieland.
Ah.
And Emma Stone cracking up.
Good
Rafer
one.
Rafer Guzman, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Exxon and Mobil, offering Synergy gasoline engineered in Exxon Mobil's Formula One fuel lab. Exxon and Mobil, energy lives here.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
A week ago, 36 people died when a fire tore through a warehouse in Oakland known as the Ghost Ship. It was one of the country's deadliest structure fires in the last 50 years. Now, the Ghost Ship was one of many illegal live-work buildings in Oakland, which had become havens for artists seeking an unconventional way to escape skyrocketing housing prices in the Bay Area. Already, city officials appear to be cracking down on these spaces. The Ghost Ship clearly seems to have been unsafe, with former residents describing makeshift stairs and electrical wires crisscrossing the building. But Gabe Moline says it's not that simple. Gabe is online editor for KQED Arts, and less than 2 days after the fire, as he was grieving, he wrote an essay, and he called it, "It Could Have Been Any One of Us." Gabe Moline brings us that essay here, set to the music of Them Are Us Too, a band who lost one of its members in the fire.
For many of us, these spaces are what have kept us alive. In a world that demands its inhabitants to be a certain way, think a certain way, or live a certain way, we gravitate to the spaces that say,
"Welcome.
Be yourself." For the tormented queer, the bullied punk, the beaten trans, the spat upon white trash, the disenfranchised immigrants and young people of color, these spaces are a haven of understanding in a world that doesn't understand, or can't. The first such space in Oakland I came across in 1994 was Phoenix Ironworks, a giant former foundry in West Oakland cluttered with furniture, mannequins, makeshift structures, and large-scale, incredible art around every corner. I spent long hours inside Phoenix Ironworks, rehearsing with my band and getting to know its residents. I've lived in, been to, helped build, or performed at dozens, if not hundreds, of similarly unsanctioned DIY artist spaces. There are thousands like me who are a product of such environments. We know the risks. We know that police and landlords can shut us down at any time. We know our creative alterations to these living spaces are not one-size-fits-all. And we are all too aware of the clashes and piling personalities of divergent backgrounds in close proximity. The bigger risks, the more unlikely ones, that such a treasured place could become an inferno in mere minutes, those don't always cross our minds. Today I know two people on the missing list, and as I scroll through news and social media for updates, hoping to see the word "safe" next to their names, I also see words like "death trap" and "unpermitted." Outsiders reporting on the tragedy inevitably get it all wrong. They mischaracterize the party as a rave, the music as EDM, and implicitly criminalize the victims as attendees of an illegal event. Hours after the fire, the tragedy is politicized. How can we explain? They don't understand why we don't just live in a $3,000 a month apartment where everything is safe and sterile and clean. Why we live in a warehouse or a garage or an attic or shed or laundry room. Why there's a mattress on the floor with a space heater where there normally would be a queen-size bed with a duvet and a nightstand and central heating. They don't understand why we congregate here at night, pushing salvaged furnishings out of the way to make room for the drum set and amps, packing our friends' bodies in like sardines, moving as one to music that never gets played on the radio. Why we play music here for each other when we could be trying to get booked at real clubs. Why we avoid those conventional nightclubs and their bookers, bouncers, security, sound men. They don't understand that we do not fit into the boxes the world tries to sell us. That their world is unacceptable, and that even for all the ragged edges, we need our own world, on our own terms. They don't understand how our music scenes become families. They shape us, make us more fearless, give us confidence, validate our dreams. We never forget what those spaces gave us. The people lost to the Oakland fire will never have that chance. And yes, there are conversations to be had about Oakland's housing supply and about the market forces that push artists into unregulated spaces. There will surely be a crackdown on the many similar warehouses in the rapidly gentrifying city, spaces with names I don't want to say so as not to raise their profile at a critical time. But for now, it just hurts. For Oakland, and for many of my friends, to be sure, but for all of us who understand.
It's been 26 years since Congress passed the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act. It's been hailed as the most important civil rights legislation since the 60s. Back in 1990, when the ADA passed, the man in the committee and on the Senate floor pushing it through was Democratic Iowa Senator Tom Harkin. Harkin is retired now, having served five terms in the Senate up until 2015. Before that, five terms in the House. But even 25 years in with the ADA, in 2015, just one in six people with a disability is employed, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Tom Harkin grew up with a brother who was deaf, and it was part of the experience and seeing his brother struggle with inequality that drove his mission to pass the ADA. Harkin is back in Washington, D.C. this week trying to keep the Americans with Disabilities Act on the national agenda. The first Harkin International Disability Employment Summit has been going on this week. It concludes today. Senator Tom Harkin is hopeful for the future of his landmark legislation.
Well, the state of the Americans with Disabilities Act, Todd, is very, very good. It's solid. We've made some great progress over the last 26, now going on almost 27 years. Things are more accessible. There's more independent living. We're getting people with disabilities out of institutions and into the community. The one place where we haven't made much progress is in employment. Jobs for people with disabilities. But I will also add that the Americans with Disabilities Act gave impetus to the United Nations drafting and passing the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which I think has been signed by over 160 countries now, and it's modeled after the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Well, we mentioned that just one in six people with disabilities are employed in the U.S. today. Does the ADA need strengthening? Does there have to be more force in the law to change that number? Or is it more about education of employers and giving them more reasons to hire people?
Well, things are starting to happen. First, you have to remember that in 1999, the Supreme Court made a decision called the Sutton Trilogy. Actually, it was three cases. And that sort of put a stop to employment of people with disabilities because it sort of employers didn't know what their rights and responsibilities were, and people with disabilities didn't know what their rights and responsibilities were. It took us 8 years until 2008 to pass the legislation to overturn the Supreme Court decision. So we've only had really a clear pathway on this in the United States since 2009, so to speak. So since then, more and more businesses are finding that people with disabilities bring a lot to the workforce, and that a lot of people with disabilities, whether they're intellectual disabilities or physical disabilities or a combination of both, have certain unique abilities that add to the bottom line. So companies more and more are finding that some of their best employees will be people with disabilities. So going ahead, we just need to get more of the private sector to do a better job of outreach, of training, working to get a pipeline of young people, especially who have come of age under the ADA, to get into the general workforce in what we call competitive integrated employment.
Well, one of the things that's changed drastically, you know, since you passed the ADA in 1990 is technology. I mean, there's been a technology revolution in the world and in this country. And the internet, in a lot of ways, has expanded access and expanded equality and choices for people with disabilities. But you've said that as we become increasingly reliant on the internet, we have to make sure that expansions also go to people with disabilities. What are some examples of how technology is marching on, maybe in the wrong way or needs to be adjusted?
Well, Todd, technology has been wonderful for people with disabilities. It has opened up a lot of occupations and jobs for people that they otherwise could not do. Now, here's the problem. Going forward, and I think this is what you were alluding to in some of my speeches, is that we have to make sure that when we design the internet and we design the platforms, that we do it with people with disabilities in mind. How are they going to be able to access, for example, job searches and qualifications for jobs on the internet? Then we need to make sure that the intranet, those programs within companies that are used to train and inform employees, that those also are fully accessible for people with disabilities. To me, that's the one big hurdle. And I always advise businesses and others in this industry, before you do this, before you before you're designing a software program, either within or on a broader basis, consult people with disabilities. Talk to them. Ask them what they need in order to have access.
Senator Harkin, before we let you go, you served for years with Senator John Glenn from Ohio, who's died. And I wonder if you could give us some of your thoughts about that pilot, that astronaut, and that senator who you knew.
I grew up in a small town of 150 people. I'd never been in an airplane, and I was a junior in high school, but I always wanted to fly. I'd never been in an airplane. And I remember there was a picture in the Des Moines Register once of this cross-country jet that had set a speed record going from Los Angeles to New York, and there's a picture of that plane there, and the pilot, was this Major John Glenn. I clipped the picture out, and I put it above my bed, and I said, I want to fly that airplane. And as luck would have it, and I hope some of my hard work and studies, I got in the Navy, and I got to fly this F-8 Crusader, same airplane that John Glenn flew, and so I flew this in the Navy during my tour in the Navy. And then, wouldn't you know it, I get elected to Congress, I get elected to the Senate, and I get to serve with that very same John Glenn. And we used to get together and talk about our experiences flying this very unique supersonic jet aircraft. What a wonderful human being. He and Annie, just wonderful. And he's just, he's just an American icon to me, especially to be able to have him as one of my heroes, someone that I wanted to emulate, and then to be able to actually serve in the Senate with him, to me, was one of the highlights of my lifetime.
Those are some great memories. Former Senator Tom Harkin, 5 terms Democratic senator from Iowa. Senator Harkin, thank you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Far from the big screen of Hollywood, Jennifer Kidwell, who's African-American, and Scott Shepard, who's Caucasian, have been pushing the boundaries of race and entertainment that we've been looking at all week long. Audience by audience, they test the limits of physical theater at their Philadelphia-based company, Lightning Rod Special. Kidwell and Shepard were the co-creators and performers in The Underground Railroad Game, a thought-provoking and at times uncomfortable performance that highlighted the tension between the history of slavery and the myths we tell ourselves about that history. John Hockenberry talked to Kidwell and Shepard about the comedic risks they took and what they hoped to accomplish by playing the Underground Railroad game.
The piece doesn't take place necessarily along the Underground Railroad, but if we were to use the Underground Railroad, the myth of the Underground Railroad as a metaphor, then we start getting to things that we're looking at in the piece, and that's this myth of the white savior, the black body in distress, and the simplicity with which we want to tell these stories about.
Yeah, I would say it's more about that the American imagination, the cultural imagination, is a feeding ground for all sorts of kinds of lies. And we take from truths and we add to them and we romanticize them so that we come up with these versions that can kind of mollify our anxiety about the truths that are staring us right in the face if we didn't have some way to hide from them.
And our piece specifically, guilt and like reparations, those are things that come up as well.
You structure this piece around a relationship. On some level, you go from relationships that were hidden to relationships that were forbidden to relationships that are completely normal. And there's somehow a line from one to the other, yet we don't know how we got here.
Yeah, the relationship arc is really interesting because one of the things we're really looking at is when you see a person, how much do you see of that person and how much do you see the idea of that person? And we kind of push into the darkest possible territories as we explore this particular relationship, kind of to see if there's anything left.
Can there be a love story?
That's
in
right.
The midst of all of this pain and torture and degradation.
But, you know, we put ourselves back on the auction blocks. We are looking at nude bodies. We are.
And language.
Yeah, we're.
Like how we actually signify our bodies. Like if you put yourself in relationship to an auction block, all of a sudden you step out of yourself and you become an image that isn't necessarily you. One thing that the piece tries to do as well is understand that just as much as a slave's position on an auction block creates a sign, the relationship of the white person to the auction block also creates a sign, and that's a situation and a system out of which that person can't step.
What was it like?
It's a real conundrum because obviously there's different, you know, levels of agency when you're in a reenactment situation. When we specifically kind of play out a BDSM sex scene.
Yeah, we should be clear though that actually my character does not get on an auction block. It's Scott's character.
Right,
does.
Right, right.
So there's an inversion there, which I think is this thing that I was saying earlier about like we all have a relationship to that system.
What do audiences say about the inversions and the BDSM and the various elements that you use to really challenge people?
One thing that makes it complex to me is this question that can come up of whether or not that's a way of a system of reparations, that it's a revenge fantasy, mm-hmm. which I don't think it's entirely divorced from that. But I, you know, hate to think that it's merely a revenge fantasy, because that actually the system of like master slave then is allowed to perpetuate itself. Right. If it's merely revenge, all we've done is switched positions. And hopefully it's deeper than that.
Yeah.
Do you feel the revenge in the scene?
In the way that he and I, like these two people are competing with each other, I think there's a latent competition that runs throughout the piece. And so there are moments in that scene where my character is in charge, but then I think by the end, that's really up in the air.
In that scene, what's really interesting is that I'm kind of on a race towards selflessness, right? Like I'm trying to become the purest, most heightened version of the white savior by putting myself into this revenge fantasy, by allowing it to happen. So there's this funny way in which we're both playing out a really perverse fantasy, and then we both kind of have to stand back and look at that fantasy and say, did that really get us anywhere? Or are we just kind of trying to expiate our guilt by doing these things that aren't actually about, you know, coming together and learning from the past.
But in the meantime, you get to see some powerful feelings about the history you carry, and you get to see in him his ability to switch it all off, because he's white. He can just switch it all off.
Well, that's the thing, though. We're all linked to the history. Like, we can't just divorce white people from the system.
Right, right.
And we can't say that, you know, like white body is constantly in a situation of perpetuating and instigating violence. There's a reciprocal violence that happens to a person, even if you're the one holding the whip. And so when we start to think about things in those terms, then maybe we can figure out how change can actually be affected.
The power of that scene is not in the action of that scene. It's actually in the aftermath. Like once the game kind of breaks and they both of the characters step away from it and look at each other, that's the longest silence in the piece. And if there's any kind of healing or understanding or humbling, that's where the reconciliation is happening.
You believe?
Not often, but there was a very conspicuous exit during that scene as soon as Scott stepped on the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the theater is tight, and like we pack these people in so close. They're like, we want to leave, but we can't leave because we're like sardines. But these people were like, I don't care if I have to crawl over you. I'm getting out.
Do you feel like you've overstepped?
I mean, that's a huge part of the piece. That's a question we ask ourselves inside the piece, as people who have kind of, if there's any moment where we kind of unmask.
How far can we go?
How far can we go? And is it right to go that far?
Yeah.
Jennifer and Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was John Hockenberry speaking with Jennifer Kidwell and Scott Shepard about the Underground Railroad game. You can hear the full hour of our series In Focus, Exploring Black Representation in Entertainment. It's all airing the Friday before Christmas.
Good Lord, ride all the way. Godspeed, John Glenn. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Yesterday, the last of the country's seven original astronauts died. John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth when his Friendship 7 capsule rocketed past the atmosphere on February 20th, 1962. It was the Mercury program, America's first manned effort in the space race.
Roger, zero-G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
That was the last time John Glenn saw that tremendous view for 36 years. He wanted to go back to space, but President Kennedy didn't want to risk losing an American hero to an accident. Glenn ended up resigning from NASA in protest in 1964 before the Apollo moon missions. But after years in the Senate and a failed presidential bid, John Glenn got his wish. He returned to orbit on the space shuttle in 1998.
This is beautiful. The best part is that do a trite old statement, zero-G, and I feel fine. I don't know what happens on down the line, but today is beautiful and great, and Hawaii is just, I just can't even describe it.
We can describe John Glenn, though. Officer, pilot, senator, American hero. John Glenn died in his home state of Ohio. He was 95. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.